Welcome to the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'm talking to the author of Revolving Door Lobbying, Public Service, Private Influence, and the Unequal Representation of Interests. The book is published by Timothy Lapira and Herschel Thomas. I'm talking with Tim Lapira now. Tim, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Heath?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I have, for at least, 2 years, on occasion asked you, is the book ready? Can I read the book? And you kept saying, no, the book, we just need a little more time. The book is now out. Congratulations. The book is great and must feel so great to have gone through all of that and gotten the book out.
Thank you.
Yeah. Before we start talking about the book, maybe you can very briefly introduce yourself and also your co-author.
Sure. I'm Tim Lapira. I am an associate professor of political science at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. My co-author is Herschel Thomas, or otherwise better known as Trey Thomas. He is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington.
Yeah, the book, as I mentioned, you guys have been working on for a while, and you've produced such a comprehensive look at a really timely issue. Before we get to all of the great data and all the great analysis, in one of the first chapters, maybe it's chapter two, you present two ways of thinking about lobbyists, two archetypes, the kingpin and the librarian.
Mm-hmm.
Would you start us out by talking about these two, what they're known for, and how they help you to conceptualize the world of DC lobbying?
Sure. Well, it turns out that these are two of dozens of lobbyists that we interviewed in person in the course of writing this book. And as it turned out, they just seemed to be such a perfect, as you say, archetypes, but perfect examples of the different kinds of lobbyists that populate Washington, D.C. And one of the things that we're trying to do with this book is not just explore the so-called revolving door phenomenon, but really dig deep into looking at important differences between different kinds of lobbyists. And these two, after having interviewed them, just seemed to perfectly represent what we thought of as polar opposites, right? They do not necessarily represent all lobbyists, but they help us tell our story. So what we call the K Street Kingpin is a well-known lobbyist. Of course, my IRB protocols, I can't share their identities. He's a well-known lobbyist who's been in the profession for decades. And he is the head of a lobbying shop at a major lobbying and law firm in Washington, D.C., with a big brand name and a list of clients longer than my arm. And he's really quite a fascinating guy. I sat with him for about an hour, and his assistant had to pull him away, that he kept wanting to sort of talk about his past. He worked for a United States senator back in the 80s, and then went out into the lobbying profession when, in his words, was relatively underdeveloped. And he just sort of told me the story about how it all works and what it was that he brought to the table. And in his own description, he said what he knows best is not necessarily policy. He is not necessarily a wonk. You know, he threw in the caveat, and I think rightfully so, that he does know things about major public policy, certainly more than the average citizen. But he said his real advantage was that he knew how things really worked behind the scenes, and that he knew how Congress operated and really what the process was outside of, say, the typical textbook version of how a bill becomes a law. So what he knows is what kind of conversations happen when, at the time, say, when an idea is going from a sort of very vague idea into a bill and looking out to build, you know, supportive coalitions. Or he knows what the meetings are like behind the scenes when Senate party leaders are trying to strategize how to go about bringing a bill to the floor and so forth and so on. So what he was really describing was that his value and his expertise is this really a strong insight into this otherwise opaque process that even many of us political scientists don't often know from an experienced perspective about how things really, really work. And what he could do is share that insight to clients to help them react or develop their own political and policy strategies. So the K Street Kingpin is this sort of big name guy who probably makes a good chunk of change. I'm working for a major lobbying firm who we juxtaposed with another lobbyist I interviewed who had no experience on Capitol Hill, had really only worked in Washington for a handful of years. She's a relatively junior lobbyist in a trade association or a professional society of librarians, and we call her the librarian, sort of jokingly, because she's not actually a librarian. She has her master's degree in information science and worked in a small state-based think tank on sort of e-commerce issues, and she was recruited by her association in Washington to sort of work on these issues on their behalf at the federal level. And that's really all she worked on was so-called e-commerce, which I'll be honest, I don't really know the ins and outs of e-commerce. But if you want to know the ins and outs of e-commerce, this is the person that you call, right? So she worked for a library as an interest in their member associations, member libraries, member librarians, work on e-commerce as one of the many services they provide to their clients. She's really the person in Washington to go to know what libraries think about how the federal government regulates e-commerce. And this is often times the ways in which state governments and local governments, provide services to their citizens, like how to pay taxes online or how to, how to get, file for a variance in their for construction or something like that. These are all the kinds of things that are involved in e-commerce, and in many obscure ways, some of the things that the federal government does touches on these items. And here she is, relative to the K Street Kingpin. She doesn't make a lot of money. She's not really interested in making a lot of money. Of course, she's comfortable in her position. But she works for a nonprofit organization. She only has one client, her employer, and she only works on maybe one or two issues on a regular basis. And that's really the scope of her expertise. So she represents the kind of lobbyist to us when we were writing. She really represents the kind of lobbyist who is the policy wonk, the policy expert, the type of person that members of Congress, folks in the White House, that they are really going to need to rely on to get good, credible information when they're considering any kind of policy change or to make some kind of policy decision. So these two lobbyists, the sort of process-oriented K Street Kingpin versus the real substantive policy expert, the librarian, helped us sort of develop our story about why understanding many of the subtle differences between lobbyists might help us political scientists understand how lobbying and actually works and how interests get represented in Washington.
Now, one of the points that you make in the book is that each of these individuals offers a type of insurance to their employer.
Mm-hmm.
And their employers are different. Now, what do you mean by lobbying as a type of political insurance? This is a different approach than others have taken, and many, maybe those that don't study this intently would typically associate with what lobbying is all about. So talk a little bit about that idea in the book.
Sure. Well, when we read the literature, we basically see the dominant framework to explain things like, why do lobbyists exist? Why do organized interests spend so much money on hiring lobbyists to do their bidding in Washington? The sort of dominant story tends to explicitly or usually implicitly assume that when an organized interest, whether it's a major corporation or a citizen group or some association of professionals or whatnot, when they spend money, that it's some kind of investment, that they're presuming that that investment is going to give them a return, that return coming from government or some kind of policy action that the government might do. Oftentimes, that return is comes from making the government not do anything, right? There's a well-known status quo bias in the policy process. And it sort of presented a puzzle for us because we were curious about why would of organized interests that know their business better than anybody, why would they keep spending money dollar after dollar after dollar when we have a government that just about anybody might point out is as dysfunctional as it's ever been? It's not doing anything, right? So why not hold on to your money and wait till the government actually, you know, does something and then start spending? It seems like from that perspective of an investment, that it was really just irrational or illogical that the amount of money being spent in politics has been going up and up and up. So we, our perspective was to think about lobbying and lobbying services being a kind of political insurance, right? And here we're, of course, using a metaphor. We don't really mean actual insurance where, you know, a group will be indemnified for if something, if the government does something bad, right? But it was a useful analogy for us because just like on my own homeowner's insurance, I pay every month in order to maintain coverage, whether I use it that month or not. And we thought of lobbyists as being in a very similar position to organized interests outside of Washington that they're worth paying for on a month-to-month basis, whether you use them or not, because at any point in time, a politically motivated member of Congress might all of a sudden decide to write a bill that might impact their industry or impact their interest in some way. And it doesn't really do you any good to hire a lobbyist after the fact, just like it wouldn't do you any good to buy insurance after a hurricane hit your house. Right? So by using this theoretical analogy, we try to change the perspective on thinking about what lobbying is. And by thinking about lobbying as political insurance, it makes a little bit more sense why organized interests would continuously spend money and continuously spend more and more money. So if on actual lobbying activities. So if that's the case, that led us to ask the question then, well, what kind of insurance or what kind of coverage are lobbyists giving their clients? And in that, by looking at it that way, we basically came up with two different, two main things that we think lobbyists, quote unquote, cover by giving their insurance. The first being a policy process knowledge. Lobbyists in Washington know a little bit more about what's going on inside the government and to help their clients try to minimize the uncertainty about what the government may or may not do in the next month, in the next 6 months, throughout this Congress, what have you. That was one thing that lobbyists, one sort of a coverage that lobbyists can provide that others can't. And then two, lobbyists know the ins and outs of public policies that those outside of Washington may not know, right? So you might, a Silicon Valley company might know a whole lot about electronic engineering and software development and so forth and so on, but they probably know very little about how, telecommunication policy might impact, say, a new business venture that they're coming up with. So where do you go? You turn to a lobbyist who has that political or that policy expertise to give you advice. So these two different risks that we say, one, the government acting on your industry, and two, the government doing something that might impact your line of business without you understanding how that's going to affect you, are the two risks that two main risks that we think lobbyists tend to cover. And it just so happens that we think that those risks map pretty well, getting back to your previous question on our archetype of lobbyists, that the political uncertainty risk is covered better by hiring somebody like the K Street Kingpin, whereas the policy substance risk is much better covered by somebody like the librarian.
Now, this idea that the lobbyists sort of fall into some different categories doesn't suggest that all lobbyists are created equally. And much of the motivation of the book we really can find in the first figure that you present. Mm-hmm. Figure 1.1 on page 9 shows a trend over time. Would you briefly explain for the audience that can't see the figure what is going on there and sort of what it says about the direction of lobbying over this time period?
Yeah, so in the first chapter, more generally, and specifically in this figure, we're simply trying to document that the phenomenon of the so-called revolving door has become more important over time. And this is something that we didn't really have to go far to sort of intuitively understand that the idea of people who had worked in government in public service at one point in time then at a later point in their career go out into the private sector to be lobbyists, that this has become increasing over time simply by just observing how much we talk about it and how much we hear about this problem. We hear about it these days, but it wasn't really a problem at all back in the 70s or 80s, or it didn't really even exist. Whether or not it's a problem, we can put a pin in that and get to it later. So we relied on some very good political science colleagues who've done some similar work trying to document this over time. And what these figures are demonstrating the best we can from the data that are available, simply showing how common it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, this figure 1.1 was the former members of Congress?
That's right.
Showing that when members of Congress leave office for whatever reason, getting unelected or just simply retiring and moving on, that it was extremely rare back in the 70s and the 80s for members of Congress to keep a residence in Washington after the fact and go to work for a public relations or a lobbying firm or a law firm in town and continue to stay with it. It used to be the case that they would go back home, quite literally retire, or maybe hang a shingle and work in law or work in whatever their chosen profession was back in their state or their district. Well, they tracked this over the time and showed that it was becoming much more common, that it was fewer than 5% of members of Congress back in the 70s did it. And in more recent years, it's approaching about half or just over 40% of senators and representatives continued in some kind of field that would we might call the revolving door. In the next figure, we show a similar a trend, but we expand that beyond just former members of Congress. We're looking at all folks who worked in Congress or the White House or a government agency, but figure, we're looking just at data we obtained from lobbying disclosure reports, which only go back in time to 1999. The law wasn't in effect until the mid-90s, and reliable data didn't become available for a few years. If we look at that, we look at the trend, and not just members of Congress, which have been the number of members of Congress who have gone through the revolving door, but an even sharper rise among especially congressional staff, that starting in the late 90s, there has just been an explosion in the number of congressional staff who've gone through the revolving door to become lobbyists. So here we're documenting in a number of different ways really what we call the problem of what the phenomenon is, to show that there has been over the past 30 years a sharp increase in the number of former members of Congress or congressional staff or White House staff who have gone through the revolving door.
Now, it seems intuitively the case that hiring a former member of Congress would make more sense than hiring a former staff person. But you actually show kind of the magnitude of this difference and how much additional revenue hiring a former member of Congress, somebody going through the revolving door, compared to a former congressional staffer, mm-hmm. or even someone with no congressional experience at all. The librarian you mentioned earlier might fit into that category. Mm-hmm. So how big are the differences in terms of how much revenue can be generated by the firm based on hiring each of these different types of people? Is this a little difference or a big difference?
It's quite a big difference. So the data that we use, in our study that we mostly rely on are from lobbying disclosure reports. And with some quirks in how the Lobbying Disclosure Act works that I'm not going to bore your listeners with now, we can only really look at revenue generated by contract lobbyists. That these are lobbyists who work at a lobbying firm and most likely have multiple clients, or at least the firm has multiple clients. And what we were able to do is calculate the per lobbyist revenue generated in the 1 year that we're really closely looking at these folks. And what we find out is pretty telling. First and foremost, and probably the most important difference is between a lobbyist with any kind of government experience whatsoever and lobbyists who had no government experience, the difference is astounding. Lobbyists who've gone through the revolving door on average are going to make about three times what a lobbyist who had no government experience would make, demonstrating that the market definitely sees the value of a lobbyist who has had this government experience. And in our terms, we interpret that to mean that in these days of government dysfunction and what is often perceived as inaction, that there is a hunger and for organizations to be sort of covered by that political uncertainty risk. But not only that, what the data also show us is that even among those revolving door lobbyists, that the revenue maps pretty well on what we might intuitively think of as the pecking order of government jobs, right? At the low end is going to be somebody who works perhaps in a member of Congress's office, in their personal office in Washington, who's going to make a certain level. But as you go up this pecking order on Capitol Hill or in Washington to having held a job in a congressional committee or in party leadership or in the White House, they're getting increasingly more valuable. And at the peak here, perhaps not surprisingly, are former members of Congress themselves. Now, former members of Congress only represent about 1% of the total lobbyist population. But as we might expect, they're at the tip of the pyramid. So they're really going to be making the most. And that fits with our story in that members of Congress have been on the floor. They've been in the cloakroom. They've been in their party's caucus meetings where, strategies and political opinions have been hashed out among their own colleagues. But for those of us who've worked on the Hill, we sort of know that the member is the peak. The member is member level communication is really the most important, and it goes down from there. And we see that mapping on pretty well to the average per lobbyist revenue in the lobbying community. So it tells us that, one, the revolving door is certainly valuable, and two, the particular kinds of experience that the lobbyist had in government is going to explain a lot about just how valuable they're perceived by organized interests.
Now, these differences that you described get to some of the individual returns to lobbyists, and maybe there's something unseemly about this. But what about the larger issues related to lobbying? In the subtitle of the book, you allude to the importance of this. In what sense is this related to the unequal representation of interest that you mentioned in your subtitle? And how does movement in and out of government relate to concerns about equality and representation and larger democratic concerns?
Well, I think the first part of the subtitle that I would point to would be the public service and private influence part. That really what we're documenting here is a change in our sort of political cultural understanding about doing political or work, right? It used to be, we might fawn about times past where it was an honorable thing to go into public service and government service, right? You might spend a career being a bureaucrat. You might spend 35 years of your life working in a mid-level congressional position and certainly have a lot to show for it. And what I think at least we're partly documenting is the trend away from that, that the incentives of work in Washington, D.C. now makes it there's such a strong pull of people to continue their careers outside of government in the private sector because they can just make so much more money. And on top of that, when we talked to many lobbyists about this, they told us that it's not just the money, but it's also that they have a lot more control over their work-life balance and what it is that they do. They can focus on issues that they're interested in. And they're no longer just sort of working for a president or working for a senator where they work in relative anonymity. And the lobbying profession offers that along with a much larger salary. But the final part is really, we think is really the most important part of the book. I mean, it would be one thing that we've crunched all the numbers looking at lobbyists and what it is that they do. But when we take a step back and we try to think about, well, what does this really, really mean? We need to recognize, we think, and based on the literature, that lobbyists aren't going anywhere. And frankly, we don't want lobbyists to go anywhere. We want interest groups to offer a robust system of information and expertise that the government can use to do its job and be responsive to the citizens like we would expect in a democracy. And frankly, lobbyists play an important role in that. They offer good information. They offer at least the opportunity to improve the quality of deliberations inside Congress and the other policy-making mechanisms inside our government. But it becomes a problem when lobbyists who have government experience, when their expertise and their process knowledge about how things go on in government have become so valuable in the market that only the most well-positioned organized interests can afford them, right? So we've long known, going back to E. Schachtschneider in the middle of the 20th century, that the interest group system sings with an upper class accent. Well, we think that if anything, this new and emerging system of valuing lobbyists based on the kinds of government experience they had is only really exacerbating that. What I mean by that is only the largest corporations and private interests can afford the K Street kingpin, right? But when there's going to be relatively fewer and fewer organizations out there that are going to be willing to pay somebody like the librarian that can offer that information and expertise. So in a political era where we have this extreme partisan competition and a decreasing levels of knowledge and expertise inside government, the price for a well-placed lobbyist is becoming is really pricing the average interest or typical organized interest out of the market. So how this really manifests itself to the unequal representation of interest is that not only do corporate and well endowed interests have an advantage that they've always had, it seems that like that inequality is growing even more in this new world of revolving door lobbying.
Yeah, the book again is Revolving Door Lobbying: Public Service, Private Influence, and the Unequal Representation of Interests. The book is published by University Press of Kansas. The author, who you've been hearing from, is Tim Lapira. His co-author, Herschel or Trey Thomas, wasn't able to join us today, but contributed greatly to the book. Tim, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. It was fun.